Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and thank you for listening to The History of World War II podcast, episode 228, an interview with Mary Jo McConaughey about her latest book, The Tango War, the struggle for the hearts, minds, and riches of Latin America during World War II. Even before the first shot of the war was fired, the Axis and the Allies were well aware of the need to control not just the hearts and minds, but also the resources of Latin America. And this fight, like the larger one, had few rules. Residents were captured to exchange for American POWs, and rival spy networks shadowed each other across the South American continent. In fact, it was the oil of Mexico that allowed Hitler to enjoy a head start in terms of resources during the first phase of the war. With the Axis enjoying early victories, the countries of Latin America had to decide whose side they would be on. But they would not be making these decisions on their own. Washington, London, Berlin, and Rome would wage their own war in the Southern Hemisphere, with FDR getting the help of Hollywood and Mickey Mouse. For whomever controlled the South American continent would be favored in the Battle of the Atlantic and in North Africa, which threatened or secured Mussolini's empire, which was, as Churchill described it, the soft underbelly of Europe. And thank you, Mary Jo, very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I have to, first of all, I just want to say thank you again for a different reason. When I was halfway finished reading your book, I realized that you had filled a very large gap for me and probably for other people about what was going on in Latin America during World War II. So you just covered a lot of things that we're going to get into, but I just wanted to say thank you because, you know, people like me who study World War II or who find it a fascinating subject, I mean, you're focused on Europe, you're focused on Pearl Harbor, but there are some very important things going on in Latin America that I did not know about. So I just wanted to say thank you and also ask, so how did this book come about and how did you come up with the name The Tango War?
I love Latin America. I've worked in Latin America as a reporter for many years, and I'd already done a couple of books about Latin America, but in the memoir genre. Mm. And so I wanted to write another, but not about myself. And my father, who was a Navy veteran of World War II, used to tell me snippets of stories about the war, including about Latin America, about Uruguay, about Argentina, about Brazil. And I at one point said, well, let me find out a little bit more about it. Maybe I can write about some aspect of that. But I could not find a single book in English that covered the entire continent, gave me the big picture. So I decided to write the book that I'd want to read and just spent about 5 years going to Latin America and several other countries and ended up with The Tango War. Now, why The Tango War? Because, as you know, the tango is a universal dance, not just Latin America, and it occurred to me while I was doing the research that one side was always closely following the steps of another, just like in the tango. Thus, the Tango War, the struggle for the hearts, minds, and riches of Latin America during World War II. the Axis and the Allies following each other step by step.
So, yeah, I'm glad you did write that because, again, like you, I couldn't find too many other books. And it just dawned on me while I was reading your book and you were answering that question. Reading your book about Latin America during World War II was the equivalent of looking at a map and then turning it upside down, like the map of Australia. Everything's still there, but you have this different perspective. And I think that's what I enjoyed most about your book, was just seeing it from their point of view and all the things that happened, good and bad, in Latin America during World War II. And we're going to jump into that. So you, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say it was a global war. Every place in the world, I think you'll find, was touched in one way or another.
Absolutely. And again, I think a lot, especially maybe in America and the UK, we have a tendency to just focus on what we consider to be the major players. But you're absolutely right. And as we're going to see, and certainly for people who read your book, Latin America had a huge influence on this war. So let's jump into this. So I was completely surprised when I read at the beginning of your book that there was, a million plus Germans living in southern Brazil, and they practically had a lock on the air industry in Latin America. Could you tell us how all of this came about?
Sure. Well, Germans migrated to Latin America for many years, even in the 19th century. But after World War I, of course, the German economy was in shambles, and so the more or less German colonies that had already existed in the south of Brazil became a lot larger, and Germans migrated much more to Latin America because they already had communities there. They were looking for a new life. They were entrepreneurs. Business was awful back home. And of course, the military of Germany was reduced to practically nothing by the terms of the Versailles Treaty, very punishing terms. Mm-hmm. So any young men who wanted to go into aviation often thought about going somewhere else, and many went to Latin America. The very first passenger airline there, SCATA, is the initials of it, was in Colombia. It's flying off of an island in the Magdalena River. That started even before Delta, which was the oldest operating airline in the United States.
Wow.
And it flew over the mountainous country there of Colombia, about which people were very happy because otherwise it just took days and days to get anywhere.
Right.
And the roads weren't reliable. There were American movies down Argentine Way and flying down to Rio, which made it look as if, everybody was wealthy and happy and glamorous in Latin America and all flying around. But you get a little bit out of the cities and you'd be caught on ruts anywhere you went. Mm-hmm. So flying was very, very popular if you could afford it. And many of the pilots were German. That SCATA was a German company.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually the Italians moved in.
Wow. So I have to ask, so if the Germans there and the Italians are there, how come the United States aren't trying to get into this market?
One of the first, the Germans used aircraft that could land on land. At that time, the famous Pan Am Clippers mm-hmm. would land on water. And so they had a bit of an advantage there. And they were there earlier, and some of the German communities, for instance, in Cochabamba in Bolivia, started their own airline.
Mm.
They were serving what was already a kind of network of Germanic towns and commercial hubs. it just either was ignored or Pan Am just didn't get down there early enough.
Ah, because the Germans, as we know, are very hard workers, very efficient people. And so I imagine, yes, with their industry, they locked this down pretty quick. And like you said, there was a very large population down there. So the 1920s go by, you come to the 1930s, and now we have the Axis powers. And the Axis powers now, because of all of this, have a foothold in Latin America. And I'm sure the local governments appreciate all the industry and the development that the Germans and the Italians, and I'm assuming the Japanese, brought them as well. So I imagine the U.S. government, as we get closer to 1939 and there's a lot of war tension, I imagine the U.S. government probably feels the need to neutralize this major advantage that the Axis powers have in Latin America. But the question is, what are they going to do about it? What can they do about it? I mean, they've got to deal with the Germans and the Italians. How do you get rid of all these already existing airline, and I'm sure all the money that flowed, but because of the Germans and the Italians, how is the Americans going to get them out?
The Americans didn't know something about that very, very important Colombian airline, which is where they were starting. They wanted to get rid of that one first. Why? Yeah, because it was being used for contraband. It was being used to fly spies around. They wanted to get rid of it first. There was something that they didn't know. Juan Trip, who ran Pan Am, had a secret. He owned it. It turns out that he had bought a share of it, but he did not want to make it public. I mean, a huge share, the controlling share. And he did not want to make it public because Colombia had a pretty big chip on its shoulder about America and Americans, because earlier in the century, with some shady maneuvers, the United States helped the northern part of Colombia break away, name itself Panama, and the United States built the canal. So Colombia was still pretty upset that the Americans had robbed them of their national territory. They did not want to give up this great airline that was doing well for them. And a lot of the Germans also that worked for the airline, in fact, that worked for a lot of the industries, became pretty involved in civic work. A lot of them became citizens. Their kids were going to school there. And there was no reason for the president of Colombia, he felt, to get rid of this airline, even though the U.S. military was very upset about it. It was flying within 200 miles of the Panama Canal. So security-wise, yeah, it was a danger.
And you make a great point in your book, and you give several examples about these people that came over after a generation or two. I mean, they feel like they are Colombians. They feel like they're Argentinians or Brazilians. I mean, they have grafted themselves successfully on to these countries, and which is going to make some of the stuff that comes later in the book more shocking. But these people have really immersed themselves into the local culture, and they are just getting on with their lives. And why should they give up, you know, something they're part of the airlines that they've worked so hard for?
Yes, but remember that at that time, Germany did not consider its people, even if they migrated out of Germany, even to the second, third generation, they did not consider them anything but German and expected their allegiance by that time to the Reich. That's not necessarily the way all the ethnic Germans felt. So it did happen that the German airline was rooted out of Colombia. Washington put so much pressure on Juan Trip and gave him a lot of financial benefits. Mm-hmm. that one day in a very, very cinematic scene, they had smuggled in all kinds of pilots and administrators, had them talking in code or communicating in code. And from one day to the next, the airline was cleansed, as the American ambassador said. They needed to be deloused.
Wow.
Cleansed of its Germans, and Colombians and Americans were put in place of the Germans. But that only got rid of the German airlines. The Italian airlines were even worse, because they were flying directly from Brazil right into the heart of the Reich by going from Rome to Berlin.
Wow. Okay, so now the Germans have been weeded out, and you do a great job in your book. I mean, the United States sneaks down a whole bunch of U.S. pilots. They fire the Germans en masse, bring these guys in, and I think we all know that the Germans are going to be very upset, but it's going to get worse for them, because after war comes, I think the Germans are going to be put into camps, maybe after Pearl Harbor. So it only gets worse for these people who are just trying to work and live their lives. I'm sure some of them, I guess, maybe were spies, but not all of them. But that's just, I guess, the game you play as far as international politics. But like you said, now it's time for the U.S. government, and I guess with Britain's help, to go after the Italians.
I think it's almost the contrary. That is, it was time for Britain to go after the Italians.
Ah.
Now, yeah, the U.S. thought it was doing it. In fact, the U.S. ambassador took credit for it, but it was all in the hands of the Brits.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because the Italian pilots were suspected of spotting for the Germans, as spotting the British ships, mm-hmm. and putting them at risk. And so the United States, for all it tried through diplomacy, could not get rid of the Italian airline called Lotti, the one that more or less took whatever spies and contraband, like platinum, for instance, a hugely valuable wartime metal only available in Colombia, took it right into the heart of the Reich. So a very, very well-known, for those who are interested, spy named Intrepid decided, that's William Stevenson, when he got orders from London to get rid of Lotti, took the mission in hand.
Mm-hmm.
He had a few options. He himself was a pilot, so he did not want to blow up the airline because his fellow pilots would be killed. It was a time when civilians were often sacrificed during the war for certain strategic goals. But he was a pilot that was also a spy's spy. That is, he felt that the best way to get the job done was not through violence. And he ran, or he founded, this place called Camp X in Canada, which was a kind of huge theater, you might say, where people rehearsed some very dangerous things. For instance, how they would go through torture and interrogation if they were caught. But they also developed tricks for counterinsurgency, and it was a fascinating place. It had actors there, it had theater people, it had mechanics, it had people who could totally duplicate wardrobes and luggage stickers so that spies going into Europe would not be suspected. At any rate, there's a story in the book about how he has a typewriter imitated to send a letter that is accidentally, quote-unquote, found and reaches the president of Brazil. The president of Brazil, who did not want to get rid of Lati, all of a sudden is reading about himself described as fat and unwieldy, and the Brazilians described as monkeys who will perform for the one that pays them the most. That letter supposedly came from the manager of Lati to the local director. And Vargas was so furious, he himself kicked the airline out of the country.
That is brilliant. I mean, that's sneaky, but that, so he literally played upon the president's ego, and we all have ego, but I imagine he thinks this letter is coming from the Italians. There's no other way for him to react, which is exactly what Intrepid wants.
Psychology.
Wow. That's incredible. You're right. He could have put bombs on planes. He could have tried to overthrow the government or whatever, but I guess it's the path of least resistance, the smallest amount, a couple of fake papers, and suddenly someone else is doing the work for him. That is utterly brilliant.
It was brilliant.
So, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. That's all. Some of these spies and espionage agents were extremely, extremely clever, and he was, I think, absolutely legendary. So many individual men are called the pattern for James Bond, but I think he comes pretty close to it.
Wow, that's incredible. So now we're getting into the heart of your book, where Latin America truly contributes, eventually, in their own way, to the Allied victory. But if you could, for a moment, could you focus on Mexico and its active participation in World War II?
Militarily, mm-hmm. It, toward the end of the war, sent the 201st Fighter Squadron, called the Aztec Eagles, to the Philippines. Roosevelt and the president of Mexico at the time pretty much knew that without some military participation, Mexico wouldn't have a seat at the table with the Allies after the war. It was not so easy, because Mexico, for some of the same reasons as Colombia, was not so favorable toward the United States. I know someone whose parents were living in Mexico at the time, and when they heard that Mexico declared war, they thought it was against the United States.
Oh my God.
So, well, you had so many invasions of Mexico by the United States, mm-hmm. so many border incursions. It was very difficult for any president of Mexico to get Mexicans in general on board with supporting the U.S. But finally, the Aztec Eagles went to Texas to train and flew, having been recognized by Douglas MacArthur later, for their efforts. They put a lot of Japanese troops out of action. Mm-hmm. They destroyed enemy-held buildings and a lot of war material on the ground. And they ferried aircraft. That was a big job there, because the war in the Pacific was getting so spread. You had Papua New Guinea, you had the Philippines, you had all of these sites, and the aircraft had to be ferried. And there were several were lost, and they were very little remembered after the war. Mm-hmm. But at least they fought and faded then into history. There is a beautiful monument for them in Mexico City, but when you ask people what the monument is, they're not quite sure what it's about.
That's incredible. But you make a good point. I imagine for the president of Mexico, as well as Roosevelt, it has got to be a slippery slope about, hey, help us, don't stay neutral, don't help Germany, even though we've taken so much of your territory, we've invaded countless times. I mean, it's got to be tricky, but I guess... And I know this sounds ironically weird, but the saving grace for both of those gentlemen was that, I think if I remember from your book, two Mexican oil tankers were sunk by the Germans and sometime in 42. And I guess that was the excuse that the president needed to actually declare war on Germany.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, that, of course, for us, for the United States, that was not far into the war. But for the rest of the parties in the war, that was already 3 years in. And the Mexicans by that time had been sending a lot of oil. This is before mm-hmm. the U-boats sank the tankers. The Mexicans really fueled those first victories of Hitler by sending oil to the Reich. The president at the time, Lázaro Cárdenas, probably the greatest president that Mexico has ever known, did not want to do it.
Right.
He was a Democrat. But the big oil companies, Standard, Shell, Texaco, they would not stand for what he did, that is, nationalize Mexican oil. He was perfectly willing to sell Mexican oil to these big companies, but they said, no, we've owned, quote unquote, this oil for decades. You can't nationalize it. They also didn't want it to have to be nationalized because they had so many concessions in other Latin American countries, and they didn't want the precedent to be established. So what happened was you had two Americans, in fact, who made that happen. Both were men shunned by these big oil companies mm-hmm. in the United States. One was none other than Fred Koch, the father of the Koch brothers.
Wow.
He was already building plants, refinery plants. He had developed an oil refining process that was more economical than what had gone before and allowed the sort of smaller companies to compete. And so he was sued by the big companies, and he went to the Soviet Union and started building the refineries for Stalin. But he didn't much like Stalin and his purges. Even some of Koch's own associates were purged. And he became a huge fan of the fascist countries. At the same time, you had man named William Davis, called the Mystery Man of World War II for his oil maneuverings, who was also shunned by the big companies and decided to go to sell oil in Germany, and asked Koch to build a refinery for him in Hamburg. And that refinery was one of the few that could process the kind of fuel that the Luftwaffe needed, mm-hmm. the German Air Force. And Davis bought the Mexican oil when the big companies wouldn't.
Wow.
So he... in fact, ran it to Germany and to Italy.
That's incredible, because before I got hold of your book, I knew that the Germans had a as far as weapons, war material, advantage over the Allies, because they started rearming much earlier, and so the Allies have to catch up. But I did not truly appreciate the actual oil reserves that Hitler had going into Poland and into France the next year, because Mexico's trying to sell its oil to the United States, I guess maybe to Britain as well. They're saying no. They've got to do something with this oil. So Davis comes along and he goes, I can sell it. It might not be the customer you want, but I can make money for your country. And that's all the president is trying to do, is, you know, keep his economy going and create jobs for his people. So that, I guess, the arrogance of the American oil companies was Germany's gain.
Right. And it was rather duplistic, because Standard and Texaco were also under the table selling oil to the Reich, especially very early.
Okay, so the Germans and the Italians are getting their oil from Mexico because they have no other place to go with it. So again, like you said, they get a huge head start. And again, that just had to be a real headache for FDR. I mean, he's probably, I'm guessing, putting pressure on these oil companies in America to relent. But I guess they still want to punish Mexico for nationalizing the resources there.
Should not only to punish them, but also to keep other countries from saying, well, hey, that's not such a bad idea. It's under our soil. Why shouldn't we get a little bit more benefit for our own national programs? So the precedent was one that they didn't want to have established. Roosevelt himself didn't push them too much at first, but eventually he was getting tired of it. It was rather unpatriotic, sure. It seemed, with the war coming.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Okay, so yeah, absolutely. So so we've got the oil from Mexico, but because this is the first big modern war in that sense, we also have to talk about the significance of rubber, which also plays into Latin America. So if you could tell us a little bit about the Latin rubber and how it affects World War II.
Yes, well, I had no idea about how important rubber would be in a war. Right. And I started looking at the list of materials that are that have rubber parts. Mm. And you couldn't wage a war without rubber on aircraft, on ships, in hospitals, every place. It's absolutely needed. And even synthetic rubber, which, by the way, the United States didn't have. Wow. At first. It did not have it. Germany had, for instance, 70,000 tons of synthetic rubber a year to the United States is 8,000 tons of synthetic rubber. But even synthetic rubber needs a portion of natural rubber in it to make products. So rubber was very important. And there had been rubber campaigns in the Amazon historically, but now the U.S. even developed something called Plan Rubber, which was a plan to take that geographical area, northeastern Brazil, if something couldn't be done, both about the rubber and to get bases in that hump of Brazil.
Wow.
It's kind of, if you look at Brazil, it's got a fist plunging into the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. Only 1,800 miles from Dakar from North Africa. It's just a little jump. And so once the fascists were controlling North Africa, people were extremely worried that there would be a jump over to Brazil, which would be bad for the Allies. And this is before the U.S., of course, went into the war. But you had dozens and dozens of meetings of the top commanders, and almost all of them had Latin America on the agenda as war was getting closer. Rubber was finally harvested by about 50,000 men called rubber soldiers. Mm-hmm. They made it a military type campaign. And at that time, there was a drought not far from the Amazon, and people were unemployed. So they readily, very often, went to the Amazon. But the cost was very, very high for this U.S.-Brazilian rubber campaign. Of those 51,000 people, 30,000 died.
Wow.
They died from malaria, yellow fever, Chagas disease, from serpents, scorpion stings, jaguars, or they fell into rivers and were eaten by piranhas. It was a terrible cost in human lives. But rubber was absolutely essential. Remember that the Japanese had invaded Malaysia and other places where the U.S. and Britain were getting their supplies. And so that was cut off. They had to look to places like Latin America. Brazil was important for a lot of other things, for manganese, which made aluminum for planes, for the kind of high-grade crystal that you could use for optical glass, for industrial diamonds that were needed for machines, you know, for machine cutting. But the rubber campaign was one that cost human lives.
That's incredible. Yeah, I had no idea, again, before I read your book, that the United States actually, you know, had to talk about seriously maybe occupying, capturing, taking northeastern Brazil, one for things like the rubber for bases and things like that. But you also have to do it in case your enemy is thinking about it, you have to get there first. So Brazil was very, very important. And I think it's January of 42, where Brazil, fortunately for the Allies, drops their neutrality and signs the Washington Accords. So we're going to have bases there. We're going to get access to the rubber. But you're absolutely right. The people that had to go get it, I mean, they just suffered by the tens of thousands, I guess, for the war effort, which is important. But again, you hate to think of all those people being sacrificed for having to collect this resource.
Well, absolutely. I mean, meanwhile, the people in the United States, they thought they were suffering, but it wasn't too bad. But there were rubber drives. People were asked to turn in raincoats and galoshes, mm-hmm. and they lowered the speed limits to save tires. They had advertising that said, when you drive alone, you drive with Hitler.
Right.
So it was the beginning of carpooling, right, to save, not only to save oil, but to save rubber too. But that was a cost, but it was a different kind of cost.
Right. And you made the point in your book that because of the Amazon rubber, that the United States had enough of it to get through until 1944, when they could finally make enough synthetic rubber. But again, for those people that lost their lives, just absolutely tragic. And
right.
And because we're talking about World War II, and again, this was something I totally had no idea about, the Jewish experience in World War II was pretty horrific. But if you think about it, I mean, they're in Catholic countries. They, you know, because of their religion, I guess they look different. Maybe they act different. But again, there's a certain segment of people, the Jews, to some degree, not assimilating. And I guess that's going to affect them. But I don't think I truly appreciated how long some of them had been there, you know, for generations, because again, they're looking for to make a living and to go to a place that will take them in and let them get on with their lives.
Well, it's important to remember that 1492, which is when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, as we remember, that was the same year that Spain ejected the Jews from and the Muslims from Spain. Mm-hmm. That was when Ferdinand and Isabella ejected the Jews. And some Jews went to the Americas right on Columbus's ship. In fact, the first person to actually sight land was one of the sailors was Jewish. They were conversos. That is, they had converted for obvious reasons, and nevertheless, many times kept to their Jewish faith and culture. Mm-hmm. They did have the Inquisition in Latin America, the very punishing Catholic Church courts. Not as many people were killed in the Americas.
Right.
They were not only Jews. Some of them were Indians, for instance, or even black slaves that insisted on keeping their own religion. But like the Holocaust, no matter who else was killed, it was aimed at Jews. Mm. And Jews were suspected by, but nevertheless, when the Spanish countries and certainly Portugal were independent, became independent in the 19th century from Europe, Jews were not persecuted in Latin America as much as they started to be suspected of being communists or somehow unassimilable, undesirables during the Second World War.
Because you were saying in your book that, as far as Berlin is concerned, you know, all the Germans in Argentina, wherever, they better be loyal because it's expected of them. But there were, I guess, Nazi groups, Nazi newspapers or whatever, and so they could spread their message of persecuting these people, even though they're not in Europe, they're not in the Third Reich, technically.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the only criticism of Walt Disney's group that went down there to be goodwill ambassadors was that they had Jews among them. This is from Nazi newspaper in Berlin. No, that and in fact, I've sat in archives looking through the newspapers from the time, and it's appalling how cartoons maligning Jews or making fun of Jews are very plentiful, and these are in mainline newspapers, but with the pro-fascist newspapers, of course, they campaigned against Jews. And there were strong Jewish communities in southern Brazil, in Argentina, in Mexico. Nevertheless, it was very difficult during the Second World War. And one of the most difficult things was that they could not know. They didn't know what was happening to their families back home. The information was so scattered, and the very few Jews who immigrated, who were able to be accepted into the Latin countries during that period, told horrific stories, but even many of them didn't have the whole picture. So there was powerful angst that affected the Jewish communities during that period. Now, there were, despite the almost the prohibition of admitting Jews during the war, even though they were refugees, mm-hmm. which, by the way, that pattern was often done in imitation of U.S. policy.
Right.
We had that policy, and Latin countries could easily say, which some did, look, if the United States isn't going to do it, I don't see, you know, why we should. But there were certain Latin diplomats who were Schindlers in their way in Europe. A Salvadoran diplomat called Jose Castellanos, who was in Geneva and manufactured untold thousands of Salvadoran passports for refugees to give them a way out of the horrors there that they were experiencing. There was a Mexican named Gilberto Bosques who took some Mexican property, that is a diplomatic, I think it was a sort of a garden and a house in Marseille, and made it a refuge for all of these refugees. And he himself and the staff at the Mexican consulate there for their trouble were captured and held by the Germans for a while.
Wow.
So there was bravery in the midst of all this horror.
Okay, so now I have to say that when I was reading your book, the item that shook me up the most, and there were a lot of things that I was incredulous about, was Crystal City and the prisoner exchange program. If you could tell us a little bit about that and the experiences of some of the families that were sent there.
Crystal City was a concentration camp in Texas, not far from the Mexican border, to which Latin American residents and citizens were brought, having been kidnapped in Peru and several other countries, as hostages to be used for an exchange program. The program was called Quiet Passages. It was secret, mm-hmm. and it was looking for individuals that could be exchanged for American civilians who were caught behind enemy lines. Mm-hmm. Now, there were over 2,000 Japanese Peruvians, for instance, taken. Often the men would be taken first and kept down in the holds of the ships, brought to Panama, where they would be forced to labor, which, by the way, is against the Geneva Conventions,
right.
Building U.S. Military camps. And then taken on to camps in the United States where eventually the families would join them. But sometimes entire families were taken. When I was looking, I'm a journalist, I'm not an historian, mm-hmm. so I wanted to talk to some people who had actually experienced this. I mean, I know an historian might well want to do that too, but that was my first thought. And I found individuals who had been taken to Crystal City, had spent some of their earliest years surrounded by barbed wire, men with long guns, saw their parents helpless with them, and still remember it. One gentleman I got on the phone, and we started talking about where we lived, and it turns out he lived one block from me. Wow. So he and two of his brothers were the only survivors of his family of, let's see, there were eight, came over and told me all the details of their lives in Peru. They were baptized Catholics, had Spanish names, and one of them even told me about going to see a movie in Lima about Tojo, where Tojo was made fun of. And he came home and he talked about it, and he didn't hurt his feelings at all, because he was a Peruvian kid, right, even though he was Japanese looking, and his parents are Japanese. And the witness of these individuals is just harrowing to hear what happened to them. Now, as we know, 120,000 Japanese Americans were incarcerated during the war, mm-hmm. but they could not be used. The Washington did not dare use them to trade for hostages, right. But they apparently thought that Latin Americans would be fair game.
That's incredible. So I guess at the time of Pearl Harbor, when the war comes in the Pacific, there's a lot of Americans who didn't know specifically that war was coming, so they're trapped behind lines. And so I guess the U.S. government has this secret program to come up with bodies, even though, like you said, they are Peruvians. They just happen to be of Japanese descent. And they're going to exchange them, send them to Japan, get their people back. And of course, these people have never been to Japan. They don't know where to go. They don't have any place to go. I imagine it was horrific for everybody involved, but I was just surprised that this was done on American soil.
Right. Well, I mean, some of them, of course, had been born in Japan, but they hadn't been there. For instance, some of the parents hadn't been there for, I don't know, 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. and they had no intention of ever going back, just like immigrants to the United States come and say, well, this is going to be where my life is. And they have their children there and they start their schools there. And they have, I mean, some of these people did not speak Japanese, that's for sure. Wow. And they learned their first Japanese in the concentration camp.
That's incredible. I do have to ask you, I know we're getting kind of long on time, but and this is going to be hard for a lot of Americans, but I had no idea about Walt Disney's part in the propaganda during the war. Could you please tell us about some of his exploits in Latin America?
Right. Well, Walt Disney was one of the goodwill ambassadors for Nelson Rockefeller. What we have to understand is that propaganda, as in any war, is a war within the war. Right. And in Latin America, the fascists were ahead of the game early on. Goebbels was head of the Reich Ministry of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda and distributed articles, films, all over Latin America. They had the Bayer company, the German pharmaceutical company, had little sound trucks where they went around to the villages and showed propaganda films. And Nelson Rockefeller said, you know, I mean, I've even been in archives where I saw articles by Adolf Hitler. I mean, that was the byline, wow, clearly distributed by Goebbels to, you know, say, you know, my vision by Adolf Hitler. So Rockefeller, whose company had a lot of business in Latin America and who personally was very affectionate toward Latin America, he tried to speak Spanish, mm-hmm. Saw the writing on the wall and decided that a propaganda, especially with the elites, was extremely important to counteract this. And at first they worked on influencing the elites, and then they started looking at the general public. Whom did everybody know? Mickey Mouse. So you know, along with Errol Flynn and Rita Hayworth and Waldo Frank and Aaron Copland, he invited Walt Disney down to be a Goodwill ambassador. Walt Disney and his crew, they called themselves El Grupo, made wonderfully attractive films that were meant to show Latin Americans as like us in the three caballeros, the three buddies. They sing a song about we're three gay caballeros, we're birds of a feather. In other words, we're all very much alike. Now, a lot of the stereotypes were still there, but there was no roughness about Latin Americans. You know, new films that Rockefeller supported tried to break with that Hollywood pulp tradition of featuring rough Hispanic characters in backwaters. Mm-hmm. They were sending the message that Latin Americans are worthy allies in the coming war. And Walt Disney, in fact, made numbers of documentaries, training films. He did a huge amount of work for the entire duration of the war and didn't take a penny for it. Unlike some of the other big companies, you know, the Ford company, the a lot of U.S. businesses naturally made a lot of money during the war. And Disney didn't charge for these kind of training films and everything, but he benefited tremendously. These films were very popular, and they also had an effect on Disney. After this experience, this very deep experience with new kinds of color, new kinds of almost surrealism and bold graphics came into the Disney oeuvre, you might say, to the Disney kind of look. Mm-hmm. And so Latin America had a big effect on what generations have seen as Disney films. You see, Disney stood for American values. Right. He wasn't overly political, and Mickey Mouse was loved by everybody. Goebbels even gave Hitler a gift once of 13 Mickey Mouse films for a birthday, and they said they were very pleased with them. So it was a smart move on Rockefeller's part to invite Walt Disney to Latin America.
So we've spoken of resources. We've spoken of the hearts and minds of the people. And there's been some actual fighting as far as as far as Mexico with their pilots. But to end on a high note, and as far as Latin America really contributing, not that the Mexican pilots didn't, but really getting in there and helping to bring about the end of the Axis powers. If you could talk about, I think it's the Smoking Cobras of Brazil. So again, I just thought what they did was amazing, their bravery and their courage. And they had to start, I guess, so far behind with either language barriers or training or maybe not being taken seriously. But please tell us about the Smoking Cobras and some of their accomplishments.
Yes. The Brazilians who know about the Smoking Cobras are fascinated by them. Mm. And when they heard that I was going to call my book The Tango War, they said, no, call it The Samba War. It's not the point. The 25,000 Brazilians went to work, fight, die with the Allies to take the parts of Italy, which were in German hands, mm-hmm. after D-Day. Many of the Allied troops were taken off for the invasion of France. Yet, Italy was not firmly in Allied hands. So the Smoking Cobras, oh, by the way, where did they get their name?
Yeah.
Hitler was reputed to have once said, oh, right, the Brazilians will fight when the snake smokes. And you see, Brazil was pro-fascist early in the war. So he was dismissing them as not fighting, let alone for the Allies. So when it came time to choose a patch, they were already in Italy, and they said, hey, we're the Smoking Cobras. And they fought alongside the Buffalo Soldiers, the Black Americans. They fought against the partisans. I'm sorry. They fought alongside the partisans, the Italian, the Italians who fought against Mussolini's troops, and they liberated towns all through Tuscany up until the north. They even breached the Gothic line, which is that impregnable, meant it was built by Kesselring to be impregnable, 180 miles long, 10 miles deep, watchtowers, tank traps. They didn't start out very well. You had Brazilians that had never been behind the wheel of a car driving these huge trucks. I mean, they had more people lost from traffic accidents at the beginning, or car accidents, Jeep accidents, than they did from dying in the field. But eventually, they were trained on the U.S. weapons. They became a band of brothers. They were trained really in the field. They were hurled against these goals like Monte Castello, which took them five attacks over 4 months to conquer. And they ended, their last action was just a few days before the end of the war. They ended from kind of fumbling and losing right at the first to capturing 14,000 soldiers, three generals, the entire 148th Division of the German Army.
That's incredible. Now, you were saying earlier that the president of Mexico and FDR knew that if Mexican troops didn't do something in the war, they wouldn't be able to sit at the table afterwards. But I didn't get the sense that's what the Cobras are about, or what Brazil was about. I have a feeling, I got the sense that they were really in it to help end the war and to defeat the fascists, even though they'd started out, like you said, pro-fascist at the beginning of the war.
I would say that the rank and file was all out against the fascists. And by the way, they included 800 German Brazilians.
Wow.
They were some of the toughest fighters. And they came from the south of Brazil and enlisted and fought like everybody else. And some of the best known names, like Max Wolf, were German, who died a few days before the war was over, were German Brazilians. Later, some of their officers took part in the U.S. supported coup of the 60s, when it became pretty difficult to live it became rather repressive to live in Brazil. So some of the officers of the Smoking Cobras supported that coup. The rank and file were rather neglected. Remember, they were over there fighting for democracy. And at home, they had a dictatorship, and by the 60s, they had a repressive authoritarian government. So they weren't even allowed to make a veterans organization until well into the 70s.
Wow.
Because people want to be reminded of these men who fought for democracy.
That's incredible. And I'm glad you brought that up, because you and I have only talked about what, maybe 70% of the book or whatever. There's other chapters that everybody should be certainly excited to check out. I finished reading the book, but I just wanted to leave something for the listeners. But you go on and you talk about Hoover's FBI versus the German Abwehr, their intelligence organization. You talk about the rat lines, the thousands of Nazis like Adolf Eichmann, Joseph Mengele, the Angel of Death, who was at Auschwitz. You talk about Edward Rauschman, the Butcher of Riga. You talk about all these people that were able to get away to Latin America, and the very complicated relationship, I guess, the Catholic Church and or participation the Catholic Church had in that. So we've only touched on some of this. You've got elements of the Cold War, you've got the rat line, and you've got, and you go back a little bit and you talk about the Vatican's, curious relationship with Hitler and Mussolini. So again, there's a lot more to this book than what we've gone over. But if you truly do not have a sense of Latin America's participation in World War II, this book will answer so many questions and give you so many, so much new information and other avenues to discuss. And Mary Jo, I just want to thank you. I enjoyed reading this book very much, and I can't wait to use it on upcoming shows, of which I will give you credit. I promise.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this.
Absolutely. So everybody, please check it out. The Tango War, The Struggle for the Hearts, Minds, and Riches of Latin America During World War II.